From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark, here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, the number to call is 1-800-462-7413. And along with your calls, some topics to talk about, Zorba.
Fast food. Hey, what's for dinner? Hey, what's for breakfast? Hey, what's for lunch? Hey, what are we snacking on?
Really? Three meals a day of fast food?
Three meals a day of fast food. We'll talk about it. And we're going to talk about the great influenza pandemic. 20 million deaths that occurred after World War I. Twice as many people died of influenza than died in the Great War. So we're going to talk about that and what that means for us today.
And what's our recipe?
Deviled eggs. Do you like deviled eggs?
Nah.
Oh, I love deviled eggs. And I rarely make deviled eggs. And this is a great recipe for Thai deviled eggs. Enjoy it.
Okay, to the phones we go now, Zorba, at 1-800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413. Our first caller, Zorba, a listener in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hello. How are y'all?
Okay. How can we help?
Yes, I had a question. My wife is a nurse practitioner, and she has been a nurse practitioner for 6 years, and she is going back to medical school, getting her prereqs out of the way. And my question is, do y'all have any advice about what she should expect and or having a family? We have a daughter who is three. As far as just what to expect if she goes back to medical school to be a MD.
A lot of work.
A lot of work, yes.
That's a lot of work. So wait, so she is a nurse practitioner. Does she have a good chance of getting into medical school? I mean, first of all, you do the prereqs. It doesn't mean you're going to get in there. On the other hand, if you're a nurse practitioner, you've got a better chance than somebody just coming out of, that's what I would think, getting a bachelor's degree. But I'm not sure in Oklahoma where that stands. What are her chances? What do you think?
I think her chances are very good. Mm-hmm. She knows some people at different medical schools in the state and around the country.
Sure.
So
that makes a difference.
She's got some good references.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I think those references really make a difference. How supportive is her husband?
great question. Yes, I am very supportive of her going back. It's a dream she's had for a while, and she's very smart, so I support her in what she's doing.
Yeah, and that really counts a lot. I know a good friend of mine actually did something very similar. She wasn't a nurse practitioner. She was a botanist, and it was an old friend when we went many, many years ago to university here, University of Wisconsin, and I went down with a friend of mine to visit. I was going to her hometown in Lexington, Kentucky, and went down to visit her, and she said, gee, you really like being a doctor? I think I'll go and be one, too. And she had a small child and went back, did her prerequisites, got into medical school, University of Kentucky, and she then, by that time, had two kids. And so there were two kids, and she went to medical school just fine, raised the kids. She didn't finish medical school in 4 years. She finished medical school in 5 years because what she decided to do and what the med school there allowed, and many medical schools do allow, is to take fewer courses and expand it to a five-year program so you can also do family things. And that's a rational way of doing things because you want to make sure you have enough time for your family, and otherwise you burn out, frankly. So it's very doable. It's something she'll be able to do. Is it a lot of work? You bet. And can she do it with a supportive family? Absolutely. And she'll do just fine with you at her side supporting her.
Yes. Well, I appreciate that, just even knowing that you can do 5 years. And on top of that, I'll give you an update when she's done.
Oh, that'd be great.
That'd be great, yeah.
You bet. Thanks a lot.
800-462-7413, the number if you have a question for Zorba. Want to talk now, Zorba, about fast food?
Very, very interesting. So before I talk about fast food, I want to talk about a New York Times article that I read years ago, and it compared fast food to rich people who had servants making their food. In other words, when we go to fast food, we don't have a servant making our food, but we really do. We have somebody who we're paying to make our food. Yep. And so when you're actually purchasing that burger or anything else you're doing, you're actually paying the wages of the person doing it. And they were comparing, they were talking about the fact that it's now become very middle class, very become something that's going on to all social classes where all of us, unless you're destitute, and even if you're practically destitute, you have, quote, a servant. You don't. You have a server. We don't use the word servant.
Yeah.
We use the word server, but it's the same word. Preparing your food.
Yeah, but if I'm a rich person, which I'm not, but if I were a rich person with a cook,
yes,
I don't think I'd want hamburgers and French fries
every day. No, I don't think so.
Day.
But I've got to tell you something. Rich people order out food all the time. Now, the very rich might have a personal chef. Now, that's a totally different thing. But one-third of the adults in the United States patronize fast food restaurants and pizza parlors. They didn't include in these in the particular article. They didn't talk about Chinese food on any given day. So one-third of us end up purchasing fast food in one way or another. And guess what? The richer you are, the more likely you are to actually do it.
Really?
It's the opposite of what I thought. What I thought was, you know, fast food, when you're poor, you're more likely to get fast food than you're rich. Not at all. It's when you're rich, you're more likely to do it than when you're poor. It's kind of, it seems counterintuitive, but,
yeah, it does,
but it's not. So if you go, you don't go to McDonald's, right?
Don't go to McDonald's.
Okay. Do you know what it costs for like a Big Mac, fries, and a Coke?
Let me guess. It's been a long time. Yeah. I used to have fast food all the time.
Yeah. Now, I occasionally go to McDonald's. I have to admit, I do have my share of fast food.
I'd say...
yeah, go ahead. Go
six,
for it.
$6.
No, $7.
Well,
it's not six bucks.
I mean,
come on. $7 is more than $6. You're close to that. So, in other words, so you have to have $7. In other words, if I go and I decide I'm going to... I get a Big Mac attack, and I do. Occasionally, I do it. I think about high school. I want a Big Mac. I want a fries. I look at it and I go, do I want to spend that much money on it? Because in my brain, it should cost $4.50 because that was the last time I was really doing that in my mind. Well, it turns out $7 is not a small amount of money. So the more money you have, the more likely you are to say, hey, I'm just going to go and get it. Well, this is an important point because it really is a major point for obesity. And it's not that the fast food places are making food that are bad for us because they want us to have bad food.
Right.
It's because that's what we've habituated to ourselves in our life.
Right.
So a side story. I'm in France. My son Eli is in France. He's in Paris. And unfortunately, Penny and I have to go visit him. What a shame. We have to fly to Paris and visit him. So she decides to stay in Paris. And unfortunately, I'm with my son Eli. We rent a car and we go to Mont Saint-Michel. She didn't feel like going there. She wanted to go see some museums. I was museumed out. And on our way back, we stopped. We were late, so we got a baguette. And we got some cheese, and we ate it in the rental car on the way back. And we're going to a friend's house who lives just outside of Paris, and she was there. We arrive at our friend's house, and I'm sitting down with this wonderful friend. He's a rheumatologist, and he said, how was Mount Saint Michel? I said, it was great. He said, what did you do? I said, well, when we came back, we were late, so we got a baguette, we got some cheese, we had some fruit, and we ate in the car. And he looked at me, and his jaws dropped, and he said, you ate in your car? I said, yes, we got a baguette, and we had a little napkin, and we had it. And he said, why would you eat in your car? It was so foreign to him that I think it was equivalent to the concept that we would sit in our toilet and eat on the toilet, which some people do in the morning, by the way.
Yeah.
It was just a totally strange thing to him. And so the answer is we eat fast food everywhere, and that's why we become a fat society.
I don't think I've ever eaten in my car.
You've never eaten in your car?
Let me tell you,
Tom, you are the minority in the United States of America.
I have not.
Really?
I used to get fast food all the time, and sometimes I'd pull up and get it, you know.
And then what?
I put the fast food next to me, and I'd drive somewhere.
Oh, my God. It would be cold by the time you got there. Besides, weren't you hungry and you wanted to eat the fast food?
What I do all the time now is frozen food in the microwave. Now, how does that compare with fast food?
Well, it all depends on the frozen food you get. So if you get frozen food at stores that have good frozen food that's more that are more expensive, you know, Whole Foods, Trader Joe's, stores like that that are more upscale, you know, in food court, you know that type of food, it depends. You can look at it and read it. You read the labels. Some are healthier. They're called Healthy Choice. That's a good example. So some of it is good. But remember, you're not going to eat it in your car because you don't have a microwave in your car to heat up that
fast
food.
Well, see, that fits right in
But that can be equivalent to fast food. That's exact the food that's prepared for you. But in that case, I think it's prepared by a machine and a robot.
Well, it tastes pretty good, the food I get. 800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. Let's get back to the phones now, Zorba. A listener is with us in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hi.
I have a question regarding arthritis. First of all, I want to say the first doctor took x-rays, and he said, you do not have arthritis. Do exercises. Well, it made my knee very, very sore.
So wait. X-rays,
so I went to another doctor.
Wait, x-rays of what? X-rays of your...
Both knees. Uh-huh.
And how old are you?
Low 80s,
okay.
Right.
Low 80s. You're a healthy person if you say low 80s versus 80s. I just want to remind you of that.
Yes,
that's right.
I am. Okay. But that's why I'm questioning. So then I got no relief. I did the exercise, and it got worse.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Or at least it didn't get any better. And so then I went to another doctor, and he was a specialist in that field. And he looked at the x-rays in my knee, and he said, you have arthritis.
Uh-huh.
So he gave me a cortisone shot.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it took about a month for it to take hold, and then I had a second cortisone shot.
Mm-hmm.
But now I'm questioning. I've never had arthritis before. Mm-hmm. And I'm questioning whether I really have it or not.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
All I feel now is there is one point, if I turn my knee a little bit funny, I will feel it.
Uh-huh.
Otherwise,
okay.
I have no arthritis ever all over my body, mm-hmm. none at all.
Okay, so let me ask you a question. Why do you care about whether or not you are have the term arthritis? What's the reason behind that? That's the first question. One doctor said you have arthritis. One doctor said you didn't have arthritis. One doctor said the x-ray was okay. The other doctor said maybe it wasn't okay. You got an injection. You got better. What's the hang-up with the term arthritis when you're 80? Now, not when you're 30 or 40. I understand that. But you're in your low 80s, and you obviously want to make it to your high 80s and your low 90s and your high 90s. But why do you care? Is it the term that bothers you?
The term bothers me because I had heard on public television that the shot mm-hmm. causes dementia.
Oh, the shot
well,
does not.
Well, I don't
want
to lose any brain cells.
Yeah, first of all, the shot does not cause dementia. So that's put even, you know, everything you hear on television isn't true. I know, that's
this
shocking.
This was a specialist, though.
Doesn't matter if it's a specialist. Shots in the joint do not cause dementia. They're wrong. Period. Doesn't work. Doesn't cause dementia.
If you hear a doctor on the radio say that.
Radio doctors know what...
This was on the radio. This was on public radio.
Yeah, well, let me tell you something.
Oh, I should think I said public television.
You
I meant
did.
Public radio.
Yes. So everything you hear... No, reverse it. Everything you hear on public radio isn't true. But let me explain something. Injections that you get in your knee do not cause dementia. What you heard was incorrect. Now, a physician who said that based it not on science. It doesn't cause dementia, period. It's either cortisone or it's a drug called Synvisc, a similar drug. Neither of those drugs have the risk factor of dementia. So let me assure you of that 100%. There's
That's
no evidence
huge.
Of that. That's huge. Okay. Now, number two. You're 80 years of age. The chances that you have arthritis are probably 95%. That's really not an issue. The question is, do you have debilitating arthritis? Now, an x-ray only gives you some of the information. So some x-rays can look good and people have arthritic pain. Some x-rays can look bad and people don't have very much pain at all. The x-ray is only a snapshot into what's going on in your knee. You got an injection. It helped, and that implies that there's inflammation there, and there's probably some arthritis there.
Okay.
Where did you go? Did you go to a physical therapist to be trained on how to do the right exercise?
No, he gave me a sheet on it.
Uh-huh. I think you should go to a physical therapist for one or two visits and learn the right exercise to do. And let me tell you why. Recent evidence has shown that patients who have arthritis, who do the right exercise on a regular basis every single day for 12 weeks, have an excellent chance of reducing their pain by anywhere between 75 and 95%. You received a sheet of paper. To me, that's ho-hum exercise. Nothing wrong with it, but if you did not get relief from the exercise you did on the sheet of paper, I think you need to go to the next step and have a professional who is a physical therapist teach you the right exercises. You're 80, so you're on Medicare. You probably have coinsurance, which every 80-year-old should have, a coinsurance to go along with Medicare. You should call your doctor and say, I want a referral to a physical therapist, and go in at least twice, once to learn the exercise and the second time to go back and see if you're doing it right. And then you do it for 12 weeks. That will give you the best chance of seeing what the benefit of exercise is. That would be my recommendation.
That's what I wanted to hear.
Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Appreciate it.
Thanks for sharing.
Thank you. We appreciate the call at 800-462-7413. Now, before we take a break, Zorba, it's time again to fire off another edition of Disagreeing with the Doc.
Disagreeing with the Doc. Disagreeing with the Doc. Oh, oh, oh.
However, Zorba, this one takes the premise of the segment and flips it on his head. The following email came to us from Mike in Madison, Wisconsin. Dear Zorba and Tom, I would like to suggest a one-time special segment called Disagreeing with the Guy Who Disagreed with the Doc.
Okay.
Okay, Zorba, before I go any further, we updated the jingle to reflect this special segment.
Disagreeing with the
Okay, Zorba, before I go any further.
But wait, Tom, in this case, shouldn't the theme song be Agreeing with the Doc?
Well, Zorba, I thought you might say that, so how about this? Okay, let's get back to Mike's email. He continues, on a recent episode, a person disagreed with you about water softeners and said that they do not add salt to your tap water. I disagree. The confusion may result from the fact that the salt you dump into your softener plays two different roles in the overall operation of the softener.
You know, this is a lot of information. I really wanted to always know about water softeners.
There's more. Most water softeners remove calcium and magnesium from hard water by replacing them with the sodium from the resin in the tank. At regular intervals, the resin is rinsed with high concentrations of sodium chloride, the stuff you dump into it in order to flush out the collected calcium and magnesium and replenish the missing sodium in the resin.
Oh.
As the person said, this is all flushed down the drain and does not get into your water. However, the sodium that removes the hardness during the normal operation does end up in the water.
Right.
According to an article in Scientific American, this adds about 750 milligrams of sodium to each gallon of water, which the USDA considers to be in the low sodium range for commercially sold beverages. So, although water softeners do not add sodium chloride to your water, they do add sodium. As noted, however, the amount added is considered low.
You know, Tom, this is on the test. So we've got multiple choice answers, and this is on the test. Everyone has to memorize this, otherwise they can't use their water softener. You know, you knew that.
I have to read this over and over and over.
Hey, it's like a test. You know, you don't get to leave the studio today without the multiple choice test.
Okay. Moving right along. Do you disagree with someone who disagreed with the good doc? Fight for our honor.
Absolutely.
By posting on our Facebook page.
Absolutely.
Or by sending us an email.
Absolutely. Zorba@WPR.org. And remember, we're on Facebook.
Yes. More calls to come, as well as our tasty recipe, all right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. With Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. If you'd like to talk with Zorba, here's the number, 1-800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, Thai deviled eggs.
Now, do you like deviled eggs?
Not particularly.
Do you like eggs?
Yes.
Eggs are not like one of your favorite foods.
I kind of like eggs, yeah.
Okay, what kind? How do you like them done?
I like scrambled.
Uh-huh.
Poached are okay.
Mm-hmm. Sunny side up? No. Over easy? Hard-boiled eggs? But it's very interesting. I mean, eggs are an incredible food.
I think scrambled
food.
Are my favorite.
But eggs are an incredible food. When you think about it, they're so different. I mean, a hard-boiled egg is very different from a poached egg.
Yeah, that's true.
It's very different.
Yeah.
I mean, most foods are not like that. I mean, if you have a steak, it's medium or it's hot, but it doesn't vary as much as an egg. An egg is really a unique food, and it's unique because it's high in protein. It's an ideal food. We used to be worried about the cholesterol. Now we're realizing we were kind of too overboard. Now, I happen to like deviled eggs. My mother never made deviled eggs, but I had an aunt who would make deviled eggs and bring them to the picnic. And one day, I said, "These are really good. How do you make them?" And you know what she said to me?
What?
"I'm not going to give you the recipe. It's my special recipe."
I know, that's a really secret recipe.
I was kind of shocked because what I was doing was complimenting her on her deviled eggs. Like, what do you do it? Like, do you put something in? Well, I found out after she died what she put in her deviled eggs.
What?
MSG. A lot of sodium glutamate. Which, by the way, actually helps deviled eggs quite a bit. Because it helped her deviled eggs. But that was her secret ingredient, MSG.
That's fun.
Which has sort of fallen to the wayside. We don't add MSG to deviled eggs. This is Thai deviled eggs. So if you are tired of regular deviled eggs and you want a different deviled egg recipe that is a fun recipe that you can bring to your next picnic or potluck or soccer game or something else, try this recipe.
And as we go through the ingredients, I'll be able to figure out what the Thai stuff is.
I think you'll figure it out. I'll probably point
it out.
Don't
count on it. Okay. Then let's try it.
So start out with 12 eggs.
For how many people? 12 people?
Eggs.
12
well, like,
eggs.
You know, they're 24 things.
Anyway.
Okay. 1/4 cup of peanut butter, creamy peanut butter.
1/4 cup peanut butter.
Creamy peanut butter.
Creamy peanut butter, yeah.
3/4 of a teaspoon of salt.
Mm-hmm.
A tablespoonful of sugar.
Big tea sugar.
2 teaspoons of your favorite rice vinegar.
2 little tea rice vinegar.
Yeah, and I would only use rice vinegar. There are a lot of different vinegars. Use rice vinegar.
Okay.
1/2 teaspoon of chili powder.
1/2 tea chili powder.
1/2 teaspoon of cayenne pepper.
Little tea cayenne pepper.
That's right. So this is going to have a little heat to it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
1/4 teaspoon of paprika, and use a good paprika. I use Hungarian paprika. That's all I use.
It's 1/4 little tea paprika. Paprika.
That's right, Hungarian paprika, something like a good paprika, not junk paprika, good stuff.
Okay.
There really is a difference because a lot of paprika is just not very good. 1/2 teaspoon of freshly grated ginger. That's what you need. Do not use dry ginger at all.
1/2 tea freshly grated ginger.
3 tablespoonfuls of coconut milk.
Three Big T coconut milk.
Now, coconut milk is a very common thing that you use in Thai cooking, and so is peanut butter. So immediately, it's the peanuts and the coconut milk that will actually give you something. So mm-hmm. 3 tablespoons of coconut milk.
Mm-hmm. 3 big tea coconut
milk. And then you're going to use crushed peanuts and some extra chili powder for garnish. Okay. Shall we make it?
Let's.
Boil the eggs in a pot full of water for 8 minutes. Mm-hmm. Drain the eggs from the water and submerge in cold water. Bring them to room temperature, so you've got to get the eggs just the right way. Peel the shells from all the eggs. Split them in half. Peeling them is always difficult. I take my hard-boiled eggs, and I throw them into a sink filled with cold water. I add a bunch of ice. Then I let them sit there. And that immediately takes the membrane that's around the egg, moves it to the side, and it's easier to peel your eggs that way. Highly recommend it. Scoop out the yolks from the egg, from the whites, of course. Combine the yolks together with the peanut butter, salt, sugar, vinegar, spices in a food processor and blend it till smooth. And if not, you don't need a food processor, but that'll make it easier, a little small one. Slowly add the liquid to the filling until it takes the texture of mousse. So you're adding the liquid from the coconut milk until it gets sort of to a texture that you can actually scoop it out. And then scoop each filling directly into the egg, or use a pastry bag to put it in, or you can use the Ziploc bag and cut the corner of a Ziploc bag and put it in there, and that works. It really works quite well. Put it on your little tray that you specially bought for this, and of course you, Tom, would buy a tray if you ever made this in your next lifetime. Put it on the tray and then garnish it with peanuts and a little chili powder on top of it, and it's great. It's a wonderful variation.
Is it really worth going to all that work?
For deviled egg lovers of the world, yes. And there are two types of people in the world, those who love deviled eggs and those who really don't care if there's deviled eggs or not. Yeah. But for deviled, I mean, there's a lot of work that goes into deviled eggs, but this is really good. I mean, these are really good. I've been loved them. You can tell I love this
recipe. Yeah, I can tell.
Yeah. You know, if people want a copy of this recipe.
Yeah, what do they do?
We no longer send it out to U.S. mail, but they can go to their favorite electronic gizmo and go to Zorba@WPR.org. You can find great recipes, but it's ZorbaPastor.org, and Zorba@WPR.org will write me an email, but ZorbaPastor.org will get you to the recipe. And, of course, Facebook.
Mm-hmm. Let's get our next call, 1-800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413. And now, Zorba, a listener with us in Brooklyn, New York. Hi.
Hi, how are you, Tom?
Fine. How can we help?
Yes, I just have a question for Zorba.
Oh, sure. How can I help you?
Yes, how are you, sir?
Very good, thank you. And
by the way, I like your life, your laugh.
Well, thank you. Thank you very
much.
Yes,
I like your laugh.
Thank you.
Going to laugh in, you know, this is very... very powerful.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
I'm just calling regarding my fiance.
Okay.
I had a couple of questions for you.
Mm-hmm.
She has 2 strokes. One that was 3 years ago.
Okay.
And one that was last year.
Last year. Wow. From what? Do they know why she had the strokes?
She has diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
And then she has high cholesterol.
Mm-hmm.
And high blood pressure.
And high blood pressure. Does she smoke, by the way, or not?
No, she don't smoke.
Okay,
she
good.
She never smoked.
Good.
She don't drink either. She
good.
Was just taking a little while once they were.
Good. Okay, so diabetes, high cholesterol, blood pressure, those were a risk factor. Well, those are risk factors for strokes. All of them independently and together, they're even more of a risk factor.
Mm-hmm. Right. So the first one, she was able to, you know, get back normal. She was walking and everything.
Okay, so
she
did okay.
She did okay. She went back to work on everything.
Mm-hmm.
But the second one last year, that was the biggest one.
Oh.
She lost her speech.
Oh,
then
terrible.
2 days after the stroke, she wasn't able to talk at all. She was communicating and writing. But she can hear.
Mm-hmm.
But she wasn't able to talk.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, as time goes by, going to therapy,
mm-hmm.
speech therapy, stuff like that, she started getting a little bit of her speech.
Mm-hmm. Good.
You know, but
good.
Not fully.
Right. Right.
Right.
Not unusual. That's a big problem.
Not unusual, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, so, and then she walked again, but, you know, she not the same as before. She, mm-hmm. you know, like, you know.
Sure. Sure. Residual problems. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then, but now, a couple months, 3 months ago, she start doing things, you know what I mean? She start going out, she start doing stuff like that. But the problem is, the speech is still, I communicate with her, she can communicate, we go somewhere, she can talk a little bit, but the speech still not coming back fully. So I was wondering if you have any advice or anything, you would recommend anything in order to see if she can come back. I don't say no more 100%. You know?
So how long has it been since the second stroke? Is, you mentioned, has it been a year since the second stroke?
Yeah, a year and 7 months.
Now, is she still going to speech therapy?
Yeah, she's still going to speech therapy. But, you know, the last session will be next week. But she's still not talking fully. You know what I mean?
Well, there are a couple of suggestions that I have. So first of all, with speech therapy, there's certain guidelines that the insurance companies want to see if the speech therapy is worthwhile. And so they have to meet certain guidelines. But also, if a physician does a second referral to speech therapy, she'll often get more visits. In other words, so there are kind of two factors in getting more visits for speech therapy. Number one, the speech therapist, and number two, physicians who actually say, I want to get another evaluation for speech therapy. Because inevitably, speech therapy is the way to develop new neurons in the brain to try to get to different areas and try to get those areas to take over speech. The problem with speech is that there are two aspects. First of all, there's the understanding aspect, which is all over the brain. But then there's the ability to articulate, the ability to say the words. And that's a very specific area that was mapped out by a guy named Broca more than 100 years ago, probably 150 years ago. And when that part of the brain dies, then speech is disrupted. And other parts of the brain have great difficulty taking over. So part of that area was killed by the stroke. But other parts of the area, if she has some speech, the ability to understand, and then the ability to talk, are still there to some extent. And the only thing that we have, the only ability we have to change that, is to keep working on it. And there are many people who have great speech difficulties, and if they continue with speech therapy and doing their exercises over time, they continue to get progress. In other words, just because it's a year and a half doesn't mean she can't get better. So I would talk to the doctor and the speech therapist and say, we want to get another round of speech therapy. There's nothing else that's magic here but that. Keeping her diabetes under control, her blood pressure, you know, her cholesterol are very important to prevent another stroke. Taking aspirin, if they've recommended that, is also very important. But speech therapy is really the key.
Okay.
So you need another referral from your doctor for that, and she needs to work on it. She will probably continue to make progress, and I assume you work with her on her exercises on a regular basis, too?
Yes, we do every day.
Of course.
Hello.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for the advice.
Oh, you're
that's
welcome.
That's her trying to talk to you.
That's right.
You,
but No, I could understand her. She said, thank you for your advice. Yeah, that's progress. She said, thank you for your advice. So she understood what we were doing, and she responded. Keep exercising the brain, and it will respond. Thank you. Thank you for sharing.
Thank
you for sharing this with us. And thank you for sharing this with other listeners who may have some similar problems. We really appreciate that.
800-462-7413, our number. And before the break now, Zorba, let's fire up the segment where you, Zorba, a real-life doctor, clarify something a listener has read on the Internet. We call it Google Doc. The following email came to us from a listener named Lori from the middle of nowhere in Utah.
Middle of nowhere in Utah.
Hi, Tom and Zorba.
Utah has a lot of nowhere, but it also has lots of places which are somewhere.
I love your show. The last time I did not wear a bike helmet was about 13 years ago, and I spent 4 nights in the ICU with a temporal skull fracture and an epidural hematoma.
Oh, terrible.
Not good.
Awful.
But after 6 months or so, I felt pretty much back to normal.
Gosh.
Well, what I've read on the internet since has me a bit concerned. I read having more than 10 CT scans can significantly increase brain tumors or cancer. I had 2 CT scans each day while in the ICU, a practice I'm told is no longer done. And years later, I had another scan for a serious sinus issue. So that makes 9 CT scans, and I'm in my 40s. Is this a point of concern?
Oh, I don't think I'd be concerned about it at all. First of all, I'd be concerned about living in nowhere, Utah, because you're just far away. But if you happen to live in Denver, which is 5,000, it's the Mile High City, that would be the equivalent of, and there's more radiation in Denver than there is at sea level because there's less atmosphere. That's the equivalent of having somewhere between 10 and 15 chest x-rays a year, just living in Denver. So the reality is, I would not be concerned about the CT scans at all. That is not the case. That is very, very theoretical. You're not going to get cancer from having those many CT scans. Now, people may disagree. We will get emails. I am sure this is, wait a minute, every time you do x-ray, you outrun a risk of cancer. They're right. Absolutely, they're right. On the other hand, you're in the ICU, and you're dying, and your brain has blood in it, and they want to know what to do. Okay, we have to do what we think is medically necessary. But I really would not be concerned about cancer with that. So getting back to Utah, live closer to sea level and you'll be safer maybe.
Did you read something online that you're not quite sure about? Zorba's here to clarify the clickbait. Just post on our Facebook page or send us an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
More of your calls coming up. Another interesting topic to talk about, our medical Mythbuster segment too, right here on Zorba Pastor and Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That number again is 800-462-7413, but Zorba, before our next call, you talk about the great influenza pandemic of 1918.
Yeah, 1918. You know, it's about 100 years ago. Lots and lots and lots and lots of people died of that influenza epidemic. In fact, more died of the influenza epidemic than died in World War I. If you look at Americans, roughly there were 18,000 soldiers that died, and there were almost 200,000 Americans who died of influenza in that pandemic. Some of them were my relatives. I had 2 of my grandmother and grandfather's relatives who died. And the interesting thing, the terrible thing about that flu epidemic, it didn't hit the very young, it didn't hit the very old, it hit people in their 20s. And the present influenza virus that's around is a descendant of that influenza virus. And it mutates every year. It changes every year. Last year, 80,000 Americans died of influenza. 80,000 Americans.
80,000.
That is roughly equal to 26 World Trade Center 9/11 deaths. You know, 9/11, there were roughly 3,000 deaths. And you do the math, and it's equivalent to like 25 or 26 World Trade Centers. You know, and so we concentrate on these terrible things that occur. You know, World Trade Center was awful and terrible. It happened all in one time, and then we forget about things that happen over a period of time, like influenza. Then the other issue is, people say, I'm not going to get a flu shot. I don't need a flu shot. I'm healthy. Doesn't matter if you're healthy. You can still get influenza. And then in words, we call the flu anything that's a cold, when in fact the cold is not influenza. It is a very specific viral infection that can get you down to the count. We don't know when we're going to have a really bad epidemic or when it's going to be a mild epidemic. Last year it was a really bad epidemic. So People don't take it seriously. And now we give flu shots pretty much to everybody over the age of 6 months. We have kids who come in and get it, and the reason is they spread it to adults. You can now get it in grocery stores and drug stores. You can get it all over the place, not just your doctor's office. And I tell people you should get your flu shot.
How well does it work?
Well, it all depends. They make at the CDC the biggest guess. It starts in Australia and then basically comes north following that. That's just the way the pandemic goes. And so they make a guess and they make all the influenza vaccine, and it's got a bunch of different things in it. I think there's 64 different combinations, something like that. And they try to make the best combination and they guess. Sometimes they're right and sometimes the flu has mutated between there and here. But in any case, there's not harm. It's useful. And remember, 80,000 people died last year of influenza. So if you've got any medical problem, get your shot. If you don't have a medical problem, get your shot. If you're a child, get your shot. Get your flu shot today.
1-800-462-7413 is our number. 800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, here's a listener in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hi.
Hi, Doc. I have a question about being really sensitive to bruising. Mm-hmm. So even if, like, I just bump into something or, like, my husband gives me a strong hug, like, the next day I can guarantee I have, like, bruise marks. And I'm kind of over it.
You're kind of over it. Well, you're not over it enough because you're calling me on the radio station. So obviously
It's so frustrating. So when I was a kid, I was rough and tumble. I always had bruises on my knees. But now I'm 46, and it's not so attractive.
It's not so true.
Yeah, you want your husband to keep on giving you hugs.
Yes.
No?
That's right. On any medicines? Do you take any medicines at all?
Nothing.
Nothing. Okay. So we can't blame it on medicines. Do you take any supplements at all?
If I remember, I'll take a multivitamin, but that's
nothing.
Sporadic.
That's it. Okay. So you've had a blood count sometime in your life, I assume, right?
So last year I got my, like, annual blood panel and everything was great.
Everything was great. So, well, some people have capillary fragility, and capillary fragility is where you just bruise all the time. And it's just the way you're made. That's just what it is. And like you said, because aspirin can do it, Plavix, a drug that can do it. There are a number of drugs that can actually produce the problem. But for some people, it's just kind of the way that they're made. And you've got to make sure there's not a clotting problem. You would know that because if you had a major clotting problem, it would have appeared well before this. There can be something called platelets, a platelet deficiency, but you would know that too because that builds up over time and you wouldn't have normal blood tests. So you have capillary fragility and that's who you are. It's just part of who you are.
Oh, yuck.
Yuck is right, exactly. So is it
mild? Because I'm also a little clumsy, and I bump into stuff.
So wait a second. You were rough and tumble when you're a kid, and you're rough and tumble when you're an adult, so you're a little clumsy and you bump into things.
Yeah, I guess. Okay, thanks, Doc. It's a pleasure speaking with you both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. We appreciate the call at 800-462-7413. Okay, Zorba, time now for our medical Mythbuster segment. This email came to us from a listener named Randy in Jacksonville, Florida. He writes, Dr. Zorba, I heard on the radio that nicotine might delay the onset of Alzheimer's. Is this true? Has it been studied, or is this a myth?
Well, first of all, smoking cigarettes does not delay. I want to make something clear about nicotine. Nicotine delivery systems that come through tobacco or e-cigarettes are not the way, even if nicotine has any value at all. Nicotine is kind of a very interesting topic. It doesn't do anything for Alzheimer's or dementia. There are some studies, interestingly, about what nicotine does to the ability to concentrate, but there's really no evidence that chewing nicotine gum gum and nicotine patches. It really helps memory or concentration. So I think a lot of this is really sort of, you know, noise on the net about nicotine and nicotine actually helping to prevent things. And I'm not sure where the noise is coming from. I don't know if it's coming from the e-cigarette lobby or just from people talking about it or people saying, I have my rights to actually smoke. A lot of the stuff that's junk on the web is really done by bots that are really more interested in disturbing normal information and saying stuff we know, you know, is really good for us and bad for us and back and forth. But bottom line is, nicotine does not prevent dementia, as far as we know, scientifically.
Have a potential myth for Zorba? Just post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org or, as you said, Facebook.
Let's get back to the phones now, Zorba, at 800-462-7413. A listener with us now in Hobart, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Dr. Zorba.
Hi.
Dr. Zorba, I have a question about ibuprofen and bone growth. I had an accident quite a few years ago and herniated some disc. And I waited a few years as long as I could. And I had a fusion surgery, bilevel fusion. And my surgeon, neurosurgeon, told me to stay away from ibuprofen because it inhibits bone growth or slows bone growth, not inhibits it, slows it down. I asked my family physician, and she said that there's nothing to it, or she'd never heard of that, not nothing to it. And then, a few years later, a couple of years ago, I had an accident, and I broke my back in five places.
Oh, wow. What kind of accident did you have?
I had a the first one is one of them hold my beer and watch this accidents when I herniated the disc, and the second accident was a car accident. I fell asleep and kind of did a Dukes of Hazzard and crashed my flew in the air for 57 feet in the air and hit the hit a bank on the other side of the creek.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I fell asleep in the morning.
Wow.
And I went back to my neurosurgeon because I broke my back.
Okay.
And he told me the same thing. That they put me in a brace, and he told me the same thing. Stay away from ibuprofen. It slows bone growth. I have a friend that is a orthopedic surgeon. He's retired now. I asked him about it, and he never heard of it. And I just want to know if he's my surgeon is telling me the truth, or has he got stock in acetaminophen?
That's very good. That's very good. But let me tell you a little bit about this, because this has been a controversy in surgery for a while. And the controversy is whether or not it really does inhibit bone growth post-fracture and post-surgery for about 8 to 12 weeks. After that, there's no question. It doesn't do anything at all. But that's a real question. And there are a number of orthopedic surgeons, neurosurgeons who say, yes, we think the data is really real and it does inhibit bone growth. And we recommend you stay away from this for anywhere between 8 and 12 weeks after surgery. And then there's another group that say there's really no evidence that this does anything at all. And you're right in the middle of the controversy. There is very little data that really shows that it inhibits bone growth. But there is some data in some studies that show that it may inhibit bone growth. So in other words, you're at maybe, perhaps, could. You know, that's kind of what you're looking at. So here it is. You know, you've had a terrible back. It's broken in five places. You're in a cast and you want to get better. And you're not really sure whether or not ibuprofen, you know, and naproxen, any of the anti-inflammatories, will inhibit bone growth, you might want to err on the side of saying, yeah, I think for 8 to 12 weeks you shouldn't take it because we really don't know. And that is probably correct. Now, your family doc and the other orthopedic surgeon were correct, though, in saying, well, They may have been correct and they've never heard about it, but it actually has been something that's been going on probably for about the last 10 years. And the data comes not from people, but it comes from putting bones in petri dishes and looking at fibroblasts, they're called, that actually make bone growth. And they're inhibited by anti-inflammatories in a petri dish. In other words, there's no hard data in humans that I've seen that's really conclusive that says it inhibits bone growth, but it's kind of an experimental thing. So that's where it fits on. Now, in situations like this, if I have a surgeon, I follow the surgeon. And the reason is if they say, I want you to do this, if it's touchy-feely, maybe, maybe not, I want to err on the side of being conservative. And post-surgery or injury, I would not use it. That's what I would do.
Well, I didn't use it, and I'm healed up.
And you're good.
I'm not going strong, but I'm going.
Now, I've got to ask you a question. Are you wearing are you wearing a seatbelt now?
Yes, I am.
There was a little pause before they said, yes, I am. So does that mean you're wearing it all the time or just part of the time?
I wear it all the time now. When I had my wreck, it wasn't on.
That's right. That's right. That's exactly what it is. And it took a long time for people to realize they have to wear it all the time. And that's exactly it. And you are lucky to be alive. And so if you wear it now, you're going to be more likely to be alive for a long, long time.
Thank you, Doc. You and Tom have a good day.
Thank you. Well, you have a good day, too. Thanks for sharing.
And before we head out today, Zorba, we love it when our listeners offer up some helpful information or interesting ideas. The following note came to us from a listener named Kate in Pewaukee, Wisconsin. She writes, "Hi, Dr. Pastor. On a recent show, you had a call from someone wondering why pickle juice might help with leg cramps."
Right.
Well, pickle juice may contain the spice turmeric, which can alleviate cramps. Because I often have leg cramps in the night, I keep a little bottle of turmeric on my nightstand. If I start to have a cramp, I lick the tip of my finger, dip it into the turmeric, and put it into my mouth. It always works.
You know something? Whatever works for leg cramps, I recommend using it. Keep doing it. It works.
Have a helpful fingertip for us. Just post it on our Facebook page or send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast,
visit on the web at ZorbaPastor.org or through Facebook.
And don't forget, you can call us anytime at
1-800-462-7413.
Zorba Pastor on your health.
That's
very good.
I got it.
Zorba Pastor.
I can memorize. My brain is still working with some of those numbers. I have been saying the same number listening for 25 years. I ought to have it in my brain somewhere.
You know, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Listen to Zorba. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen. Our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, asking you to join us on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
For more Zorba Pastor on Your Health, including episodes, recipes, and tips mentioned on the program, visit ZorbaPastor.org. This year, we're celebrating the show's 25th anniversary, and we want to hear from you. How has Zorba helped you out? What have you learned from the show over the years? Leave us a message at 800-462-7413.